for a while that we could do this without transforming the larger system in which the food system is embedded. In other words, that we could transform our food system without having to transform capitalism. I think it's pretty clear that that's impossible. So now that really overwhelms people. Oh, you mean we have to change everything? Well, actually, I think we do. And then people get overwhelmed.
Right, they do. They get overwhelmed, Eric, especially when there's so many other things and people have to live their lives. So break this down for us, right?
What else were you busy doing? I mean, let's go ahead and change everything. I love Naomi Klein's book, This Changes Everything.
Uh-huh.
Well, it's time to change everything. But the other side of that is that food and the food system is pivotal within capitalism. Food and capitalism have co-evolved. So if we think about it strategically and use a little bit of political jujitsu, one can see how if we make sort of very politically strategic changes within our food system, we can begin to change the larger capitalist system. And, you know, this is a thesis, of course, and I think we need to test it because we don't have much time. With global warming, with the tremendous migrations that are taking place because of, you know, economic and political and climate refugees, we've really got to take hold of the food system and use the food system not just to feed ourselves better food, not just for the food sovereignty of being able to determine, you know, how we grow, process, eat, distribute our food, but because that's the lever to change the larger system, which is driving the rest of the problems we have, like the climate change and the financial crashes and the tremendous inequities in and disparities in wealth that have developed over the last 20 years.
You're listening to Sprouts Radio from the Grassroots, a weekly program bringing you local radio productions of national interest. Today, you're listening to a show produced by Rootstock Radio, a weekly radio show exploring food, farming, and the global future. We return now to our interview with Food First Executive Director Eric Holt-Demenis.
We are talking today about food justice, equity, and what the solutions are. So let's try to focus on that a bit. So you can use food system as a lever. The lever is going to radiate changes out in the rest of different systems. And yet, you've talked a little bit, even on this show, and you talk a lot in your books, and just how big and ingrained the way things are today. So talk to us about, like, where do you start? I mean, you do a lot of work with Food First. You have a lot of strategies. You have a lot of programs. Talk about some of those things for us about how do we start to move those levers.
Absolutely. Well, I think that the first thing we have to realize, particularly here in the United States, is that we are not in the minority. Those of us who want to transform the food system are not in the minority. We're in the majority. Because if you look around the world, in fact, you have, you know, the growth of peasant movements around the world fighting for food sovereignty, for example. Just Via Campesina, which is a peasant federation, has 200 million members. And they have extensive alliances, like with the World March of Women and with the climate justice movement. And so that one can see that, in fact, what you and I are talking about is already happening politically around the world. And it's happening on the ground, too. I mean, people are refusing to participate in the corporate food regime. And so many of the very promising alternatives that we see around the world and here in the United States, like, you know, organic farming, permaculture, agroecology, CSAs, farmers markets, farm to school programs, you know, on and on and on. These are all great things. And we need to keep doing all those things. But we need to do something else too. We need to change everything.
back to that plan of changing everything. Okay.
But we need to take political responsibility for what we're doing, for the potential of what we're doing. And so it's great to be talking about the prefigurative politics of, you know, we're going to be the change we want to see in the world, and we're going to work in our communities, and we're going to establish non-hierarchical organizations, and we're going to support the leadership of women and people of color. And that's all fantastic. We have to do all of that. And we are. But we need to take a step further. We need to find a way to converge in all of our diversity so that we become a powerful movement for social change, powerful enough to create the political will that's needed to institute the structural changes, not just the changes in practice, but changing the rules of our food system, which essentially means changing the rules of capitalism.
For everything. So
that's right.
So what you're suggesting is, yes, do all of the groundwork and all the things that are already happening, but the biggest piece is going to be all of us figuring out how to work together.
It's the political piece, yeah. I mean, you know, we kind of looked on here in the United States as being sort of the, you know, the crazy fringe, you know, wants to talk about, you know, veganism and foodies and, you know, on and on, that is crazy people. Organics and, you know, all these things. Like, this is all niche stuff. Mm-hmm. It's very nice, but it really is not going to work for the whole world. And so we're just kind of nuts. If you look at the food movement globally, think of it more like a balloon. And we're positioned somewhere on this balloon. And the balloon keeps expanding and expanding and expanding, getting bigger and bigger. So we're not the lunatic fringe. We're part of the cutting edge. And the contradictions within capitalism and within our capitalist food system are really coming home to roost. You know, the capitalism has to expand always or die. And so it's always about, you know, economic expansion, economic growth. When, well, we're running out of resources and people are getting poorer, not richer as a result. And so clearly this has to change. So those contradictions, I think, are really coming home to roost. And so the more that the food movement reconstructs our public sphere, you know, that sphere outside of the market, where we make decisions based on what is right rather than what the markets tell us to do, and the more we recapture our commons, those areas in our lives where we, you know, base our decisions on a moral economy, and we manage things for the good of everybody, not just individuals. The more that we can do that, the more traction we're going to have in the face of what it really is, a deteriorating capitalist system.
It's a fascinating, hopeful, and intriguing set of ideas there, Eric. I love that. You know, some people might say, hey, I look around the world and I see communities that mostly feed themselves. And, you know, a lot of that is being grabbed up by these larger companies that you have been talking about here. But, you know, when you say, well, these are nice little niches over here, but yes, but people feeding themselves and their communities has been the way that most people in most parts of the world have done it.
And it's still happening. You know, we're under the illusion that that corporate agriculture feeds the world. In fact, only less than 15% of all food even crosses borders worldwide. So the rest of the food, the other 85%, is being grown locally and consumed locally. So this whole business about, you know, feeding the world, it's not about feeding the world at all. The world is feeding itself very well for the most part, except they can't keep the food to feed themselves. Mm. What's at stake is that market. That 85%, corporate agriculture wants that market, because they have to expand. And the justification or the rationalization is, well, we need to feed the world. Well, actually, the world could feed itself if we would let it. And I think it's important not just for hungry people and rural people to be able to feed themselves. This is important for everybody. And here's why. Let's do a thought experiment. Let's just look into the future of a completely corporatized, industrialized food system. What would that do? Well, the first thing it would do is it would displace a third of humanity. It would move all these small farmers out of the countryside. I say move, you know, It would eject them violently from the countryside. That's what's happening now with land grabs. The question is, and we're already seeing the problems resulting from this, but if you follow it out, well, the question is, where's everybody going to go? There is no new industrial revolution to sop up all this labor, and Microsoft's not going to do it. So the world economy would have to grow at something like 15% a year over the next 50 years in order to sop up all this labor. Well, that's impossible. We're not even growing at 2%. So clearly, people have to stay in the countryside. The problem is, for most of the world, the countryside is not that nice of a place to live. So we have to reinvest in the countryside. So we have to make a social commitment to the countryside. The countryside has to be a good place to live. There has to be, you know, food, water, electricity, healthcare, schools, roads, I mean, all these things. We're paving over the countryside. We've got to reverse that. We've got to green the city, and we've got to make the countryside an attractive place for our young people to make a living.
Mm. So, Eric, you have a new book called A Foodie's Guide to Capitalism, Understanding the Political Economy of What We Eat. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Very exciting. So if our listeners want to hear more about these issues, they could go and get A Foodie's Guide to Capitalism, Understanding the Political Economy of What We Eat. And this is by Eric Holt Kamenas, our guest today on Rootstock Radio. And it is from Food First Press. And
so this is a co-publication between Food First Books and Monthly Review.
Well, thank you so much for writing it and for that work. I do find your ideas incredibly hopeful and a great roadmap for people who are trying to make changes and to do what they can to influence the system. Eric, one more question before we have to sign off here. What's your advice for people to stay buoyant, to stay focused, and to keep going?
I can only say what I do. You know, at Food First, we study these things, and sometimes you're sitting behind the computer for 8 to 10 hours looking at the most depressing information and statistics in the world, you know, and then you have to go home and get up the next day and do it again.
Right.
And the only way that we have been able to do this and not lose hope under what is, you know, if you're paying attention, is a very pessimistic scenario,
mm-hmm.
is to ally oneself with those for whom losing hope is not an option. And that's what we do at Food First.
Mm.
So we really need to listen to the voices of the people who are making the changes on the front lines of our food system, both not to lose hope and also to learn about all the exciting things that are happening and coming together.
Eric? If our listeners want to learn more about your work, we've mentioned several of the books that you've been involved with. Is there a website or someplace they could go to find all this in one place?
Yes, I encourage everybody to visit the Food First website. It's www.foodfirst.org.
Fantastic work. Thank you for all you're doing out there. And Eric, thank you for joining me today.
That's it for Sprouts. You've been listening to Rootstock Radio's interview with Eric Holt Jimenez. Sprouts' theme music is Torpedoes on Tuesday by Poison Control Center. Sprouts is a weekly program produced in collaboration with community radio stations and independent producers across the country, bringing you local radio productions of national interest. The program is coordinated and distributed by Pacifica Radio. Thanks to Michael Yoshida at Satellite Operations. If you or someone at your station has a radio production that you wish to rebroadcast on Sprouts to showcase it nationally, contact our air traffic controller, Ursula Rudenberg. Ursula@pacifica.org. This week's producer was yours truly, Charlie Knorr. Thank you for listening, and see you next week on Sprouts.
Take two.
Take two.
Yo, peace, what up? It's homeboy Sam AK with Free Radio, Santa Cruz, all right? My peoples at 101.3, online at freakradio.org. I'm talking about the real ish. I'm talking about the unlicensed, commercial-free, community radio pirate. Just because them play what the people want. Peace.
And now, stay tuned for Tim and the Gang on Maximum Rock and Roll.
In the air, I've lost contact and I'm in despair. I pat my back and it's a big thrill. Something goes wrong and you're ready to kill. You're the leader of the scene, which you've never been, and you don't even know my name. You've been mistreated and you've been done wrong, so you get with the group and put it in a song. I pat my back and it's a big thrill. Something goes wrong and you're ready to kill. You're the leader of the scene, which you've never been. You don't even know my name, and you think that you're ready for the world, cause all you've got is fame. And you take what's theirs and change it into yours. You think it's all the same. Both our hands in the air. I've lost contact and I'm in despair. I pass the back and it's a big thrill. Something goes wrong and you're ready to kill. You're the leader of the scene, which you've never been. You don't even know my name, and you think that you're ready for the world, cause all you've got is fame. And you'll take what's theirs, change it into yours. Think it's all the same. At the top, you're at the bottom. But bottom when I'm forgotten, I'll fade and sink until I'm under. Someone else will steal my thunder. I'm at the top, you're at the bottom. What will happen when I'm forgotten? No one else will stop and pause. Stop to listen to your stupid cause. You're the leader of the scene, which you've never been. And you don't even know my name.
Maximum Rock and Roll Radio. That was from Hozak's Archives, Low Life from Canada, doing Leaders. I'm Dan, but you probably already know that because you are more than likely one of the people who are reading, what the fuck? I've been up since 4 a.m. Listening to this show on the website, although you may be listening to it on your local radio station. If you are, that's pretty fucking rad. This is stuff from the new bin. This is No Negative doing Cellophane. We'll be right back. Maximum Rock and Roll Radio. It's a little too early. Sorry, American Hate. That song was For Mom, which is the final song off of the Our Love Is Real LP. For that, Dianetics doing The Evolutionary Level Above Humanity. Before that, Heavy Lids doing Bleed. Before that, Beyond Peace doing Old Crop. And to kick things off with No Negative doing Cellophane. But none of these songs are as good as the song that Joan is about to play as she makes her MRR radio DJ debut.
That's right. I took one of the most popular LPs of last year, according to the entire world. This is the title track to the most recent Lebenden Toten LP. It's called Mind Parasites. Check this shit out.
Хотя нам прошлого немного жаль, лучшие, конечно, впереди. Скатертью дальний путь стелится и упирается прямо в небосклон. Каждому лучшее верится. Катится, катится голубой вагон. Может, мы обидели кого-то зря, Галинда закроет этот лист. К новым приключениям спешим, друзья, эти байкоходы машинист. Скатертью дальний путь стелится и упирается прямо в небосклон. Каждому лучше верится. We'll be right back.
Come on!
tuned into Maximum Rock and Roll Radio. This is Joan taking up all of Dan's time with one six-song set.
Sorry. We're like a six-song set.
Yeah.
Six songs.
We just heard from Bastard. I absolutely had to play Bastard. The first time I talked on the phone with Martin from Los Crudos and Limp Wrist, he asked me how I was different from Grace, the previous coordinator. And I just told him that Grace is obsessed with Kleenex and I'm obsessed with Bastard. And that's pretty much the greatest difference between us. So we heard the last song on Wound of Pain, Truth. We also heard before that S21, Rest in Peace, with Brass Gavel. Jerry's Kids before that with Raise the Curtain. No Trend before that with Mass Sterilization Caused by Venereal Disease. SPK from Australia with Slogan. And the first song we heard was Libenden Toten with Mind Parasites. And I'm going to hand things off to Dan now.
I had a couple more sets planned, but Joan set the record for the most time filled by the fewest songs, which is cool. So I'm going to just pick the best of what the rest of us going to play. And, of course, Liquids is the only band from the Midwest, I suppose. And this is Lucky Knife.
I'm
Maximum Rock and Roll Radio. That was Vanilla Poppers doing Hard Work. Before that, Helta Skelta doing Autodidact. Before that, Cody Tuhoa, I believe, doing Hajota Ja Haliste off of their LP on Southern Lord. And it started things off with Liquids doing Lucky Knife. And now a word from our sponsor. Thank you for tuning in to Maximum Rock and Roll Radio.
We really enjoy being able to bring you the best DIY punk rock
from around the world every week for free.
If you like what you heard, why not donate to ensure we can keep the music coming to you?
Donating is easy and tax deductible. Go to our website,
MaximumRockandRoll.com,
and click on the donate button.
Yes! God, I'm so stoked!
For more information about this radio show, check out our website,
radio.MaximumRockandRoll.com.
Email us requests or comments, radio@MaximumRockandRoll.com.
If you'd like to be considered for review in the magazine or play on this radio show,
send 2 copies of vinyl
or 1 copy of CD-only release and your cassettes
to MRR P.O. Box 460760, San Francisco, California,
94146
in the U.S. of A.
Maximum Rock and Roll Radio is edited by Kalu, and we have a clean version of the show available thanks to John Carnes.
Slight correction, it is now edited by Brandy Howell, who is doing a great job. Got one last song. This is Pandemics doing Exit Strategy off of their LP. Thank you, Joan, for playing a killer set. Maximum Rock and Roll Radio, thanks for listening.
You are the target of those who would trample the liberties of free men. You are in the crosshairs of the bomb site an enemy is centering on you. You are a citizen of the free world, a citizen of the United States of America. Today, in the age of hydrogen weapons, our president has told us, you are the target. Wherever you are, take cover.
Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
It doesn't make sense that I have to wait till I'm 21 to get a handgun, but I can get this weapon at 18. I don't know. So I was just curious as to what you did in your bill.
We didn't address it, Mr. President. Look, I think
you know why? Because you're afraid of the NRA, right?
Two weeks after the school shooting in Parkland, Florida, President Trump appears to break with the NRA and his Republican colleagues, urging lawmakers to pass comprehensive gun control measures, including expanding background checks, raising the minimum age to buy guns, and other measures. But Trump is still pushing to arm teachers and get rid of gun-free zones. We'll speak with the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence, the Campaign to Keep Guns Off Campus, and Randy Weingarten, president of the American Federation of Teachers.
Children should be valued for their guns. Children should be valued for their guns.
We'll also look at the Arctic, where temperatures have soared to record-shattering highs. The alarming heat wave is causing scientists to reconsider even their bleakest forecasts of climate change. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Parkland, Florida, teachers and students at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School returned to classes Wednesday for the first time since Valentine's Day, when gunman Nicholas Cruz opened fire with an AR-15 semi-automatic rifle, killing 17 people, wounding 15 others. This is Stoneman Douglas student and shooting survivor Samuel Safate.
Spanish class, my teacher was taking attendance, and she accidentally said Luke's name while she was doing roll, and like a lot of people just started crying because we all knew that he was gone.
Last month's massacre sparked unprecedented youth movement led by Stoneman Douglas High School students who are mobilizing a nationwide rally against gun violence called March for Our Lives in Washington, D.C. on March 24th. Meanwhile, in New Mexico, schools on the Jicarilla Apache Reservation were placed on lockdown Wednesday after a caller phoned in a threat of a mass shooting. The nearby Navajo Technical University also locked down for several hours. Elsewhere, in Dalton, Georgia, police arrested a social studies teacher named Jesse Randall Davidson after he barricaded himself alone inside a classroom and fired shots from a pistol as a principal tried to enter. This is Dalton police spokesperson Bruce Frazier.
When the principal put a key in the door to try to unlock the classroom, Mr. Davidson apparently fired a shot from a handgun through an exterior window of the classroom. It did not appear that it was aimed at anybody. It obviously broke out the window, and at that point, the school went into lockdown.
At the White House, President Trump renewed his call Wednesday to arm teachers and other school employees with concealed firearms. But Trump also shocked members of his own Republican Party when he appeared to reverse course and support raising the age that a person can purchase a rifle from 18 to 21. He also called out Pennsylvania Republican Senator Pat Toomey during a meeting with lawmakers at the White House.
It doesn't make sense that I have to wait till I'm 21 to get a handgun, but I can get this weapon at 18. I don't know. So I was just curious as to what you did in your bill.
We didn't address it, Mr. President. Look, I think
you know why? Because you're afraid of the NRA, right?
No, not an issue.
Trump's proposal came as Walmart said Wednesday it will raise the minimum age to buy guns and ammunition at its stores to 21. The retailer also said it would remove items resembling assault-style rifles like airsoft BB guns from its online store. The move came as Dick's Sporting Goods said it would stop selling all assault-style rifles at its Field and Stream stores and would similarly raise the minimum age of gun sales to 21. CEO Edward Stack said he expects backlash over the move, but added, quote, "We don't want to be a part of this story any longer." Nicholas Cruz had bought a rifle at a Field and Stream store. Alaskan Republican Congressmember Don Young is under fire over his recent comments that Jews would not have suffered the Holocaust if they had been armed. This is Congressman Young in a recording aired this week by Alaska Public Media.
How many millions of people were shot and killed because they were unarmed? 50 million in Russia. Because their citizens were unarmed. How many Jews were put into the ovens because they were unarmed?
That was Alaska Congressman Don Young. In a statement to the Washington Post, the Anti-Defamation League condemned Congressmember Young's comments, saying, quote, "It's mind-bending to suggest that personal firearms in the hands of the small number of Germany's Jews could have stopped the totalitarian onslaught of Nazi Germany when the armies of Poland, France, Belgium, and numerous other countries were overwhelmed by the Third Reich," unquote. In Syria, airstrikes and artillery fire continue to pound the rebel-held Damascus suburb of eastern Ghouta as a daily five-hour humanitarian pause brokered by Russia unraveled completely. The UN's humanitarian affairs coordinator, Mark Lowcock, said Wednesday the deal failed to allow even a single vehicle to access the besieged region.
So, if there's been no humanitarian access since the resolution on Saturday, what has happened in the last few days? More bombing, more fighting, more death, more destruction, more maiming of women and children, more hunger, more misery. More, in other words, of the same.
The fighting in eastern Ghouta raged as Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov denied reports that Syria's military launched a chlorine gas attack on eastern Ghouta, calling it a provocation aimed at sabotaging the humanitarian pauses in fighting. On Capitol Hill, three U.S. senators have introduced a bill that would force Congress to vote for the first time on whether to continue U.S. support for the Saudi-led coalition's war in Yemen. The measure was introduced by Republican Mike Lee, Democrat Chris Murphy, and Vermont Independent Senator Bernie Sanders, who noted the Constitution gives Congress and not the president the power to declare war. Sanders said the U.S. was contributing to a humanitarian catastrophe in Yemen.
The United Nations Emergency Relief Coordinator said that Yemen was on the brink of, quote, "the largest famine the world has seen for many decades," end quote. So far, at least 10,000 civilians have died and over 40,000 have been wounded in the war and 3 million people have been displaced. Many Americans are also not aware that U.S. forces have been actively involved in support of the Saudis in this war, providing intelligence and aerial refueling of planes whose bombs have killed thousands of people and made this crisis far worse.
In Honduras, police injured at least six demonstrators outside the U.S. Embassy in Tegucigalpa Wednesday as they protested a visit by Nikki Haley, the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. The protest came as Haley met with the Honduran president, Juan Orlando Hernandez, who was inaugurated for a second term in January despite allegations of widespread voting fraud in the November 26th election. Back in the United States, White House Communications Director Hope Hicks said Wednesday she'll step down in the coming weeks. Hicks' announcement came a day after she appeared before the House Intelligence Committee to answer questions about alleged Russian meddling in the 2016 election. As part of her 8 hours of testimony, Hicks told lawmakers she sometimes told white lies on behalf of Donald Trump, though denied any of the lies were about Russia. Hicks is a 29-year-old former model who joined Trump's campaign in 2016 without any experience in electoral politics. She was romantically involved, reportedly, with Rob Porter, the former White House staff secretary who resigned last month after both of his ex-wives accused him of verbal and physical abuse. She's one of the closest advisors to President Trump. The Washington Post reports special counsel Mueller is looking at Donald Trump's efforts last summer to oust Attorney General Jeff Sessions in the latest sign the investigation's looking into whether the president may have committed the crime of obstruction of justice. Mueller's reportedly looking into a series of Twitter attacks Trump made on Sessions last July and August, and whether Trump was attempting to force Sessions out to replace him with an attorney general who would rein in the Russia investigation. The news came as Trump took to Twitter Wednesday to launch a fresh attack on Jeff Sessions, calling his decision to launch an internal affairs investigation into alleged surveillance abuses at the Justice Department disgraceful. The Post also reports Trump now refers to Sessions derisively in private conversations as Mr. Magoo, referring to the bumbling cartoon character. President Trump's former campaign chair, Paul Manafort, pleaded not guilty Wednesday to new criminal charges brought by Robert Mueller, the special counsel in the Russia investigation. Manafort faces dozens of charges and two separate indictments, including conspiracy, tax evasion, bank fraud, money laundering, and failing to register as a foreign agent, even as he secretly worked as a lobbyist for Ukraine's pro-Russia government. Last week, Manafort's top aide, Rick Gates, pleaded guilty to charges and is now cooperating with the special counsel's investigation. The White House said Wednesday President Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, will retain his role as senior advisor, even after he was reportedly stripped of security clearance, allowing him to view top-secret documents. Kushner failed to report over 100 foreign contacts on his initial application for permanent security clearance, which he has since revised three times. Meanwhile, the New York Times has an explosive report on Kushner's real estate company receiving multi-million-dollar loans after he met with powerful financial executives at the White House. One loan for $184 million came from Apollo Global Management months after Kushner met with the company's co-founder, Joshua Harris, at the White House and reportedly discussed giving him a job in the Trump administration. Another loan, even larger, for $325 million came from Citigroup shortly after Kushner met with the bank's chief executive, Michael Corbett, at the White House. Department of Housing and Urban Development Secretary Ben Carson's under fire after his office agreed to spend $165,000 on furniture in its Washington, D.C. headquarters. Details of the purchases, which include a $31,000 dining set for Carson's office, emerged this week after a HUD whistleblower said she was demoted after she refused to exceed a $5,000 spending limit on office furniture. The purchases came as the Trump administration proposed slashing HUD's budget by $6.8 billion, or about 14%. In Britain, investigators with Scotland Yard said Wednesday they've opened another criminal investigation into disgraced Hollywood producer Harvey Weinstein. The latest complaint from a Westminster woman who says she was sexually assaulted by Weinstein in the mid-90s brings the total number of British women who've brought complaints against Weinstein to 10. Native American author and filmmaker Sherman Alexie apologized Wednesday over multiple anonymous allegations of sexual misconduct against him. Among the allegations, author Litza Dramusis wrote online that over 20 women have accused Alexie of sexual harassment. In a statement, Alexie said, quote, "Over the years, I've done things that have harmed other people, including those I love most deeply. To those whom I have hurt, I genuinely apologize. I am so sorry." The head of the U.S. Olympic Committee, Scott Blackmun, is stepping down over his handling of the case of Dr. Larry Nassar, the former USA gymnastics team doctor who was convicted of sexually abusing hundreds of women and girls. Blackmun's resignation came after the Wall Street Journal reported he and the U.S. Olympic Committee failed to intervene in 2015 when they first heard allegations of Nassar's sexual abuse, a full year before the crimes were reported publicly by the Indianapolis Star. In West Virginia, public schools remain closed today after the state's teachers union remained on strike over the high cost of health insurance. On Tuesday, West Virginia Governor Jim Justice agreed to boost teacher salaries by 5% in the first year of a new contract. But the teachers say the deal isn't enough to offset skyrocketing premiums in the Public Employees Insurance Agency. Some 20,000 teachers and 13,000 school staffers say they'll remain on strike until they win a better agreement on health care costs. In Argentina, convicted mass murderer Luciano Benjamin Menendez has died in prison at the age of 90. Menendez was a senior military commander nicknamed the Hyena during the U.S.-backed Argentine dictatorship of the 70s and 80s. In 2010, Menendez was sentenced to 13 terms of life in prison for crimes including torture and murder at secret detention camps. Menendez died without ever confessing what he did with the bodies of thousands of activists who were disappeared during the dictatorship. In Bratislava, Slovakia, hundreds of people took to the streets to protest official corruption following the murder of the prominent investigative journalist Jan Kuciak and his girlfriend last week. At the time of the murders, Kuciak was investigating tax fraud by people associated with Slovakia's ruling party. His final story was headlined, "Italian Mafia in Slovakia, Its Tentacles Reach as Far as Politics." This is Slovak politician Igor Matovic speaking at Wednesday's protest.
Jan Kuciak didn't remain silent. He had the courage to speak out about powerful people in this state, and that's why they've silenced him. They also want to silence us, politicians as well as journalists, and you. They just want us to shut up and vote, shut up and vote.
And in San Francisco, California, hundreds of protesters chanting "Shut down ICE" marched on the offices of U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement Wednesday. The protesters blocked streets and locked themselves together to barricade doors at ICE's building. The protests came on the heels of an ICE sweep that's seen over 200 immigrants arrested by ICE in Northern California this year. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. 2 weeks after the mass school shooting in Parkland, Florida, that left 17 people dead, 14 students and 3 teachers, President Trump appears to have broken with the NRA and his Republican colleagues. At a televised White House meeting with lawmakers Wednesday, Trump urged Republican and Democratic lawmakers to pass comprehensive gun control.
You have to be very, very powerful on background checks. Don't be shy. Very strong on mentally ill. You have to be very, very strong on that. And don't worry about bump stock. We're getting rid of it where it'll be at. I mean, you don't have to complicate the bill by adding another 2 paragraphs. We're getting rid of it. I'll do that myself. Because I'm able to. Fortunately, we're able to do that without going through Congress.
During the meeting, President Trump accused Pennsylvania Republican Senator Pat Toomey of being afraid of the NRA.
Think of it. You can buy a handgun. You can't buy one. But you have to wait till you're 21. But you can buy the kind of weapon used in the school shooting at 18. I think it's something you have to think about.
Can we just sign it?
So, I'll tell you what, I'm going to give it a lot of consideration, and I'm the one bringing it up, and a lot of people don't even want to bring it up because they're afraid to bring it up. But you can't buy a handgun at 18, 19, or 20. You have to wait till you're 21. But you can buy the gun, the weapon used in this horrible shooting at 18. You are going to decide. The people in this room pretty much are going to decide. But I would give very serious thought to it. I can say that the NRA is opposed to it. And I'm a fan of the NRA. I mean, there's no bigger fan. I'm a big fan of the NRA. They want to do it. These are great people. These are great patriots. They love our country. But that doesn't mean we have to agree on everything. It doesn't make sense that I have to wait till I'm 21 to get a handgun, but I can get this weapon at 18. I don't know. So I was just curious as to what you did in your bill.
We didn't address it, Mr. President. Look, I think
why? Because you're afraid of the NRA, right?
No,
it's not
an issue. The NRA
5 years ago.
Yeah, it's a big issue right now, and a lot of people are talking about it. But a lot of people are afraid of that issue, raising the age for that weapon to 21.
After the White House meeting that stunned people across the political spectrum, the NRA criticized President Trump. NRA spokeswoman Jennifer Baker said, quote, "While today's meeting made for great TV, the gun control proposals discussed would make for bad policy that would not keep our children safe. Instead of punishing law-abiding gun owners for the acts of a deranged lunatic, our leaders should pass meaningful reforms that would actually prevent future tragedies," the National Rifle Association said. Well, we're joined now by 3 guests. In Washington, D.C., Randy Weingarten is with us, president of the American Federation of Teachers. She wrote an open letter to Trump on Wednesday explaining her opposition to his push to arm teachers, which he's continuing to do. Also in Washington, D.C., Chris Brown, co-president of the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence. And here in New York, Andy Pelosi, executive director of the Campaign to Keep Guns Off Campus. I want to begin with Chris Brady. I want to begin with Chris Brown, who is one of the co-chairs of the Brady Campaign. The Brady Campaign, of course, named for Jim Brady, who was shot in the head in the attempted assassination of Ronald Reagan. Chris Brown, what was your response to yesterday's White House meeting?
Well, just after the meeting, my co-president Avery Gardner and I issued a release saying that we agree with President Trump and actually think that a comprehensive approach to the issue of gun violence is long past due, that a comprehensive expansion and support of our background check system is necessary, that we should look at the issue of the assault weapons ban. And, you know, the other issues that he embraced, we are clearly in support of, and actually legislation is pending in Congress to do all of those things. We appreciate that he wants to have a comprehensive solution, that he appears to be bucking the NRA, and we certainly hope Congress is able to deliver a comprehensive package to him to solve this issue.
Hmm.
Now, he still did call for the arming of teachers, and I want to go to that meeting where President Trump stood by the idea of arming school personnel.
First, we must harden our schools against attack. These include allowing people with a certified training, very talented people, to carry firearms. And some people are going to disagree with that, and I understand that. I fully understand that. And if you do, I want you to speak up today, and we'll listen.
Randy Weingarten, your response to this proposal?
You know, the more you know about this, the more you know about schools, and the more you think through this proposal, the more insane it is. And it's not that we don't believe that there should be a comprehensive solution. We completely agree with what the folks from Brady just said, and all the issues that they have raised and we have re-raised over the course of the last, 10 years or so. But think about what he's saying. Even prisons don't arm correction officers in the interior of a prison. First, schools need to be safe sanctuaries, not armed fortresses. And if we can do that with planes and we can do that with federal courthouses, we need to be able to do that with schools where our kids are. Secondly, think about what he's talking about. Logistically, what is a kindergarten teacher going to do? Wear her gun on a holster? What about somebody who has been certified? Where's that gun going to be? Is it going to be in a locked thermal closet? Is it going to be in a locked closet? Where's the key going to be? Is a handgun actually going to be able to stop someone who's deranged with an AR-15? So, you know, there are lots of things we should be doing. Like, you know, if communities want, there should be armed security personnel who are trained in the perimeter of schools. There should be a bunch of different safety ideas. There should be the mental health issues. But we also have to get guns off the streets and not into schools.
I want to bring Andy Pelosi into this conversation. Andy Pelosi is executive director of the campaign to keep guns off campus. Now, that's mainly college campuses you're talking about, but you've worked extensively for years in Florida and, of course, across the country. President Trump did repeatedly say that gun-free zones are the most dangerous places there are. They attract killers, he said.
Right. And I really think that that's a myth in and of itself. I mean, the mass shootings that we've seen over the years, most of those mass shootings have been done by people that either have grievances in the workplace or they have some type of a connection to the school. There's always a connection for the most part. And in many cases, those people know that they're going to die during that incident. So
they think that they themselves are going in and committing suicide
exactly.
at the same
time. And I did want to tag on to what Randy just mentioned, that we're in full support of not arming teachers. The last thing we need to do is be adding more guns into the mix. The students in Parkland and across the country, they're leading on this issue, and it's very important for us as advocates as well as elected officials to listen to them. They're angry, but they're also afraid. And we have to hear that and do something about it. There are other things we could be doing to protect the schools environmentally, hardening our schools. There are so many things short of introducing weapons. Teachers should not be carrying weapons, and that's non-negotiable for us in Florida right now.
So I'm going to play a clip, and I want people to guess who is speaking.
We believe in absolutely gun-free, zero-tolerance, totally safe schools. That means no guns in America's schools, period, with the rare exception of law enforcement officers or trained security personnel.
Yes, that is Wayne LaPierre, head of the NRA, speaking almost 20 years ago in 1999 after the Columbine massacre, in which 13 students and one teacher were killed. That's Wayne LaPierre, Andy Pelosi.
Yes, it is. And after Columbine.
Saying don't arm schools.
Right.
And talking about the importance of gun-free zones.
Right. And their solution, again, the gun lobby's solution to this problem is adding more weapons, whether it be on our streets with concealed carry permit holders or in our schools, having teachers whose main job is to teach our kids. That's not the solution. And when you talk to security experts...
But that is Wayne LaPierre with a completely opposite point of view. He's saying what you're saying.
He was saying what we're saying, yes, 19 years ago after Columbine, yes. But he doesn't feel that way anymore.
In fact, he has seriously, the NRA has gone after even now President Trump in what he has proposed. Chris Brown, the clips one after the other were quite astounding. For example, when Steve Scalise, the majority whip in the House, who is a shooting survivor himself, we didn't know he would make it for a little while. On the ball field just a while ago, but has recovered, and was talking about conceal carry. Let's go to Congressman Steve Scalise and President Trump's response.
If you look at the concealed carry population, these are people, by and large, who are helping us stop crimes. These are people who are well-trained, who actually go out there and help prevent crimes. So I would hope that that's not immediately dismissed, because there is a lot of talk of just putting that on the side and
but
just
Steve, I do think this. You know I'm your biggest fan of the whole world. All right? I think that maybe that bill will someday pass, but it should pass as a separate. If you're going to put concealed carry between states into this bill, we're talking about a whole new ballgame. And, you know, I'm with you, but let it be a separate bill. You'll never get this passed.
I mean, the Republicans were gobsmacked in the room. Chris Brown of the Brady campaign, were you? This is President Trump admonishing a shooting survivor who wants concealed carry, who one of the most powerful forces in the House.
We were pretty surprised. But then again, President Trump likes to be, his own man, so he says. And so, ultimately, the policy directives that he embraced in that meeting yesterday are four square in line with what we know at Brady is necessary to save lives. The concealed carry, so-called concealed carry reciprocity bill that Representative Scalise was referencing, we call the Arm Anyone bill. It would basically allow anyone to obtain a concealed carry license anywhere at any time, and law enforcement opposes it. It effectively eviscerates permitting standards and other requirements that states have put together to determine who can carry a concealed permit when. It tromps on states' rights, and we think it's very sensible that the president is saying you should not include a bill like that in bills like expanding background checks and closing gaps in the background check system that actually are about saving lives.
Explain the background checks. Explain what is being asked for. Explain when someone says background check, how they might be eviscerating background checks and what a meaningful background check system would look like.
Happy to do that. Thank you so much. And I have to say, yesterday was the anniversary of the Brady background check system, the 24-year anniversary of it. That law was enacted actually in 1994. And what it says is if you're a federally licensed firearms dealer, you're required to conduct a background check before someone purchases a gun. The issue is that in the time since that law was enacted, there's this thing called the Internet. And there are gun shows where private sellers who are not subject to the law are able to sell guns. As a result, one in five guns sold today is sold without a background check. We also have a system that allows a background check to proceed, the sale to proceed, if the background check has not come back within 72 hours. That's called the Charleston loophole, because that's how the shooter in Charleston was able to secure a gun. The background check had not yet come back on him after 3 days, and the seller sold it anyway, and he went on to kill people at AME Baptist Church. We want those gaps closed. It will save lives. The background check system today has stopped the sale or purchase of 3 million guns to individuals we all deem dangerous. The third thing we want is an investment in the system so that federal and state agencies charged with inputting names into the system have appropriate funding to do that. We saw the problem with lack of that with the Sutherland Springs shooting, where the shooter had a charge against him and a conviction that should have been put into the background check system by the Air Force. It just wasn't put in.
He'd attacked his wife and baby, or partner and baby.
That's right. He'd been dishonorably discharged from the military. His record, therefore, should have been put into the system by the Air Force. Within 24 hours, they did admit that. We have a problem. Many state and federal agencies are not appropriately inputting the names into the system. That needs to change. So what Donald Trump appears to be embracing is an expansive reform of the background check system. There are bills pending in Congress to cover all of these things that will save lives. We want that comprehensive package presented to him for signature.
And when President Trump spoke to Senator Cornyn, who was right next to him, who is sponsor of the Fix NICS bill, can you explain what this is, why you feel it doesn't go far enough? Although by the end of the meeting, Trump was turning to him and saying, you're going to add all this other stuff, right?
Yes, he was. So the Fix NICS bill is an important first step. So what it would fix is that last issue I just referenced. It provides more money to state and federal agencies to ensure all names we already agree and are required to be put into the system are put into the system. What it doesn't do is actually address the gaps in the system that allow 1 in 5 guns sold today to be sold without a background check. So it doesn't close the private sale loophole, and it doesn't close the Charleston loophole that allows a gun purchase to proceed even without a background check. So we want universal background checks, and we want appropriate funding to state and federal agencies. And there are 3 bills pending that would do all of those things.
And those bills are?
There is the Fix NICS bill. There's a bill, I don't have the number, but it's in the House and the Senate, to actually close the Charleston loophole. And there's another bill introduced also by Senator Murphy that would close the loophole, the 1 in 5 loophole, and ensure that all background checks apply to all gun sales, whether private or through federally licensed firearms.
That's Senator Chris Murphy, who was elected right after Sandy Hook.
That's correct.
Right before Sandy Hook, but before he took office. We're going to continue this conversation. Chris Brown is head of the Brady campaign. Andy Pelosi is with the campaign to keep guns off campus. And Randy Weingarten is head of the AFT, the American Federation of Teachers. After that conversation, we're going to Copenhagen. We're going to talk about what's happening in the Arctic. Stay with us.
And we are to the teeth. We're all working together now to make our lives mercifully brief. And school kids keep trying to teach us what guns are all about. Confuse liberty with weaponry and watch your kids act it out. And every year now, like Christmas, some boy gets the milk fit suburban blues, reaches for the available arsenal, saunters off to make the news. And the women in the middle are learning what poor women have always known, that the edge is closer than you think when your men bring the guns home. Look at where the profits are.
To the teeth,
by Annie DeFranco here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're going to go back to the White House meeting yesterday that stunned people across the political spectrum, but may well be attributed to what took place, well, very far away in Parkland, Florida, where the kids were returning to school. That's right, where the children who have survived the Parkland massacre, the Valentine's Day massacre, where Nicholas Cruz opened fire with an AR-15 and killed 17 people, 14 students and 3 teachers. They went back. They're going back for a few hours each day, not allowed to have backpacks. They don't want them to have books. They have over 100 dogs to help them feel good in the school, many counselors. And interestingly, in the morning, they didn't go to their homeroom. They went to the room they were in, or the group of people they were with. The freshman building where the shooting happened was sealed off. They went to their fourth period class so that they would be with the students they were with when the massacre took place, to draw comfort, to be back together again. This is the pressure on the Florida legislature. This is the pressure on the White House right now. This is the pressure on Congress. These young people in mourning are also taking aim, and they haven't stopped since right after the massacre, demanding that the adults take action, that they pass legislation. They want these assault weapons out of the hands of those who could kill them. So we're going back to this White House meeting on guns, and this is President Trump speaking about how law enforcement should respond to reports about potentially dangerous individuals.
Take the firearms first and then go to court, because that's another system, because a lot of times by the time you go to court, it takes so long to go to court to get the due process procedures. I like taking the guns early, like in this crazy man's case that just took place in Florida. He had a lot of firearms. They saw everything. To go to court would have taken a long time. So you could do exactly what you're saying, but take the guns first, go through due process second.
Take the guns first, go through due process second. Chris Brown, head of the Brady campaign, can you respond?
Well, I have to say, among the various things that he said, I found that the most surprising. You know, we have long supported the enactment of what are called extreme risk protection laws. 5 states now have them. Embedded in every single one of those is a due process standard. And it basically allows family members and law enforcement who have an at-risk individual or see an at-risk individual, someone at risk to themselves or others, to have an expedited process and review and hearing before an order is issued. We think that's appropriate, despite that fact, actually, and the fact that due process is incorporated in every state that has now enacted these laws. The NRA has fought us tooth and nail every step of the way, saying that somehow due process is not considered. So it was with some shock that I watched Donald Trump basically say that a hearing is actually not even necessary, and that if law enforcement see guns with someone who's at risk, they should just seize them at that time.
And then I wanted to turn to Democratic Congressmember Stephanie Murphy in yesterday's meeting.
I have a bipartisan bill to remove the so-called Dickey Amendment, which has prevented, over the last couple of decades, the CDC and other federal agencies from researching gun violence. And I think that your Secretary of HHS has said he thinks we should be able to research gun violence. It's a key piece. Having facts and scientific data is a key piece in helping us address this national public health issue. And so I would hope that we as lawmakers can have opinions about policies, but we should all have good sets of facts. And it's an easy fix. We just have to strike one sentence in the existing law to enable us to conduct the research that's much needed.
Chris Brown, can you explain what this CDC reference is?
Yes. Over a decade ago, a member of Congress included in an appropriations funding bill a rider language that said that the CDC could not spend any funds actually studying gun violence prevention. Over the course of many years, that rider has been interpreted to preclude the CDC from actually spending dedicated funds associated with gun violence research. So the bill that Representative Murphy, who was elected and represents the area where the Pulse shooting occurred and defeated a 10-term incumbent, John Mica, has is to actually provide funding and authorize funding for CDC research. We absolutely agree that is critical. We have a scourge, an epidemic of gun violence in this country that claims over 96 lives a day and injures hundreds more. It is a travesty that we don't actually spend significant funds understanding how best to address that issue and ensuring that researchers are appropriately funded to find the solutions to this. We have many, but research is essential, and we strongly support that bill.
And now I want to turn to Senator Dianne Feinstein, who was sitting right next to President Trump at the beginning of this meeting when she was with on one side of President Trump and Senator Cornyn, his what was expected to be his ally, was on the other. She wouldn't even look at Trump, as many Democrats didn't. By the end, it was the Democrats who were smiling and supportive. Dianne Feinstein did appear surprised, or I should say that President Trump appeared surprised, that AR-15 machine guns could be purchased in stores.
What do we do about weapons of war easily accessible on our streets?
What you're going to have to do is discuss it with everybody, and any solution. No, it's a very complex solution. You do. You have weapons on the street. That's what we're talking about with black market. These are black market weapons. And, you know, the problem, Diane, is that these aren't where you walk into a store and buy. These are where somebody hands you a gun and you hand them some money.
Oh, no, you
money.
Go into a store and you can buy an AR-15.
You can.
You can buy a Tech-9. I mean, you can buy all these weapons.
So that's Senator Feinstein. Andy Pelosi, your response, and talk about what exactly you're calling for right now.
Well, thank you. I think that, you know, the federal assault weapons ban expired in 2004. There are seven states that have their own bans. After the Pulse shooting in Florida in June 2016, the Florida coalition that we're a part of called for two things: a ban on assault weapons in Florida and universal background checks along the lines that that Chris was talking about before on the state level. After the Parkland shooting, we've renewed our call, and that call is really being led by the students. They want a state ban on assault weapons. They want a federal ban on assault weapons. And the public is behind this. You know, large numbers of people are in support of this. These are two provisions that we continue to push before the Florida legislature. The legislature will be done very soon. Their proposals right now are much more watered down, quite frankly, and they include arming teachers. And what we really need in Florida are solutions that are going to reduce gun violence and not just small proposals raising the age to 21, which is good, but it still includes the selling of assault rifles in Florida.
Randy Weingarten, the Florida House Appropriations Committee in Tallahassee advanced a bill that would require sheriff's departments to offer teachers training in carrying guns in the classroom. The program would spend $67 million to establish teachers and school staff with concealed weapons. Your response to this?
Again, as I said before, it's insane. And frankly, think about this, Amy. They have done this at the same time as they advanced a bill to strip teachers of their voice in schools, so that when we talk about what works and doesn't work in schools, they don't want to hear that, but they want to arm teachers and with weaponry. We want to be armed with social workers. We want to be armed with lower class size. We want to be armed with the things that we need to do to help kids. I just want to chime in with your other two guests, because there are common sense solutions here. We have to have the wraparound services. We need to actually think through new safety measures. One of the students said that the active shooter training actually really helped, and you watched how those teachers really helped shield kids. But at the end of the day, if we don't get assault weapons out of our streets and our schools, we're going to see more of this. last thing I would say is not just the Dickey Amendment, but just like auto manufacturers are not immunized from liability, just like tobacco manufacturers were not immunized from liability, why is it that the gun industry has a complete pass for anything and everything it does? Everybody has to take more responsibility here, as does the gun industry, and I think we should actually look at those immunity statutes and pull them away as well.
I wanted to end with the words of Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School student Emma Gonzalez, who gave a dramatic speech calling for gun control on Saturday in Fort Lauderdale, the first Saturday after the Valentine's Day massacre.
If the president wants to come up to me and tell me to my face that it was a terrible tragedy and how it should never have happened and maintain telling us how nothing is going to be done about it, I'm going to happily ask him how much money he received from the National Rifle Association. In the 1.5 months in 2018 alone, that comes out to being $5,800. Is that how much these people are worth to you, Trump? To every politician who is taking donations from the NRA, shame on you.
So that was Emma Gonzalez. And Splinter just came out with a piece talking about what Emma Gonzalez mentioned at the beginning of her speech when she warned, I know that this looks a bit long, the paper she was holding for her speech, but these are my AP Gov notes. And she was talking about the fact and referred to and has repeatedly thanked her her government teacher, her AP government teacher, Mr. Foster. On the day of the shooting, Foster taught the AP Gov students about special interest groups like the NAACP, American Medical Association, and the National Rifle Association. His lesson plan that day included a discussion about the Columbine and Sandy Hook school shootings with emphasis on how every politician comes out afterward a tragedy to say the right thing about changing gun regulation. The students learned how the NRA goes to work as soon as news reporters and the public move on the next story. And Foster said, that's not the NRA's fault. That's our fault. We lose attention, and that's why interest groups run the country. If it's not the NRA, then it's another group. And this is a lesson that they had right before the massacre took place at their school. I want to thank all our guests, Chris Brown of the Brady Campaign, Andy Pelosi, the campaign to keep guns off campus. But I want to ask Randy Weingarten, head of the American Federation of Teachers, one unrelated question, but because it's happening right now, not far from you in West Virginia, public schools remaining closed today after the state teachers union remained on strike over the high cost of health insurance. It was believed that the strike was ending yesterday when Virginia Governor Jim Justice agreed to boost teacher salaries by 5% in the first year of a new contract. But the teacher said the deal wasn't enough to offset skyrocketing premiums in the Public Employees Insurance Agency. Explain what the demands are.
Sure, Amy. And also, let me just say, what that teacher did in that class, the kind of voice that teachers need, that is what the Florida legislature is trying to strip from them, that kind of autonomy. In West Virginia, there's no collective bargaining in West Virginia. So it is whatever we lobby the legislature and the governor, and we got to a deal, so to speak, of increasing salaries by 5% this year. It's, you know, it is not enough because of what West Virginia teachers make, and they need to make more, and to actually freeze the premiums for about 18 months. The problem is the bills have not actually gone through a very hostile House and Senate, and no one trusts the governor. And so until some of these bills go through and there's a task force that actually takes on these huge premium hikes over the long term, you have a lot of confusion. So there's been a bunch of what the union said to the governor and to the legislature was, give us 2 or 3 days to actually talk to our members about what deal we think we have struck and get these bills through the legislature, and they didn't want to do that. And as a result, the schools were closed on Friday. We are working very hard to get schools open on Monday. The real issue is people just don't trust that legislature and that governor because their salaries have gone down, and all these fights that we've had to try to raise these issues before the strike were unheeded. They were not listened to until the strike.
Brandi Weingarten of the American Federation of Teachers, thanks so much for being with
us.
Thank you. When we come back, we're going to look at what's happening in the Arctic. The Arctic, where temperatures have soared to record-shattering heights. What does this mean for the world? Stay with us.
¿Recuerdas tu pueblo, aquel pequeño y soñador? Y los caminos que bajan al valle no te llaman la atención más. Pues donde vives son más anchas las calles y es más grande la ciudad. Vives en una gran ciudad. Las mujeres son bellas, todas parecen modelos. Pero cuando buscas su alma te das cuenta que la perdieron frente a los espejos. Pero aquí tenemos grande el corazón y nos brillan más los ojos.
Here Is Your Land by the Guatemalan rock band Alushnual. Its former drummer Lenin Fernandez died on Monday. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. In news on the environment and climate change, scientists are expressing dismay over unprecedented warm temperatures in the Arctic. In recent days, temperatures at the North Pole have surged above freezing, even though the sun set last October and won't rise again until later this month. On the northern tip of Greenland, a meteorological site has logged an unprecedented 61 hours of temperatures above freezing so far in 2018. The record-breaking temperatures are connected to an unusual retreat of sea ice in the sunless Arctic winter. Scientists suggest warming temperatures are eroding the polar vortex, the powerful winds that once cushioned the frozen north. The alarming heat wave is causing scientists to reconsider even their bleakest forecasts of climate change. According to a leaked draft of a scientific report by a United Nations panel of scientists, quote, the risk of an ice-free Arctic in summer is about 50% or higher, with warming of between 1.5 and 2.0 degrees. For more, we go to Copenhagen, Denmark, where we're joined by Jason Box. He's a professor in glaciology at the Geologic Survey of Denmark and Greenland. Jason Box, it's great to have you on Democracy Now! Can you explain what is taking place?
There's actually a lot going on in this story, and I think it's worth zooming out to the increase in the amount of heat-trapping gases in our atmosphere. The greenhouse effect has been enhanced by human burning of fossil fuels. That's elevated atmospheric CO2 almost 50% now. Okay, so that's heating the planet. And it's the Arctic that is warming at twice the rate of areas to the south as a consequence of this. And there are feedbacks that allow the heat to stay in the Arctic. And when the sea ice, which has lost half of its thickness in the last 50 years, moves away from the shore, we have an ocean surface that is about 30 degrees Celsius warmer than the surface would otherwise be of the ice. That releases heat into the atmosphere. And there's something called the lapse rate feedback, which allows that heat to to get trapped near the surface in the atmosphere. It allows it to warm up further. So there's an interaction between the loss of Arctic sea ice that's been retreating. It's now at record low. It's about the area of Alaska below its average. The interaction of that heat release with warming in the lower atmosphere that reinforces the slowdown of the jet stream, the polar vortex. They're the same thing. And what's normal is the jet stream polar vortex to have a circular shape around the Arctic. But the warmer it gets, the Arctic, the more wavy that structure becomes, and the jet stream starts to meander more. And those meanders, they get locked in. This is a signature of climate change, a more persistent wave pattern, which is now driving extra heat into the Arctic that wasn't possible before, and allowing more heat out. Right now in Copenhagen, it's been very cold the last week at the same time it's been so warm in the Arctic. Now, if we just look back to the earlier this winter when it was so cold in the eastern U.S., it was record warm in Alaska. This is the same type of phenomenon where you have heat being driven up to high latitudes and cold coming down, and it's persistent, and it sticks for days, weeks, even months. This is a signature of Arctic climate change, the loss of Arctic sea ice, the again, more heat exchange into the atmosphere in the Arctic winter. And something similar happens in summer where we lose the reflective cover of sea ice. Then the 24 hours of sunlight is absorbed in the ocean, heating it up. And all of this is reinforcing this slowdown and lazy patterns of the jet stream.
I wanted to ask you, Jason, I know there's a delay between us, so I'm going to ask two questions and you can answer them both as we speak to you in Copenhagen, about other impacts of